Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
We're going to go to Australia now, and you might have seen that first photo in the newspapers during the week of one Paul Mescal and the lead role for the new Gladiator sequel. Well, someone keeping a close eye on that is my first guest, Oscar-winning actor Russell Crowe. Good morning.
Well, it's morning for you, but it's actually evening for me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here. Now, before the world of film opened up to you, there was the music. It's always been with you. And so that's where we're going to go to today. You've kindly chosen some tracks that mark a moment or a spark, a memory for you ahead of your own show, The Indoor Garden Party, which will take place here in Dublin in the Gaiety Theatre on July 1. But first, let's go back to your childhood, Russell, and maybe start with your parents' line of work. They were making a living by catering movie shoots. And I'm just wondering, were you charged with that kind of creative energy from a very early on point in your life?
Well, my mum and dad did lots of different things, actually. My dad was a, for example, I mean, he ran a contract sorting wool at one point. He was a scaffolder at another point. He was a real estate guy at another point. But we moved to Australia in 1968 at the end of the year. I was 4 years old. And my mum had always sort of, you know, fancied learning cooking and stuff. And she'd been doing, you know, Asian cooking courses and stuff like that when we got to the big city of Sydney, when those sort of things were available. And it was quite unusual. I was the only kid on the block who had a, you know, 1 kilo block of what they used to call bean curd sitting in the fridge, which is now we know as tofu. So friends would come from school and go, "What is that?" You know, because it wasn't a good look. But my mum's godfather, who was quite a famous producer of very cheap television, and he managed to convince my mum that she was such a good cook that she should be a caterer on film sets. The only reason he's doing this is because he famously doesn't like spending money, and he knows he can con his goddaughter into working for him for cheap. So for about 4 years of their life, my mum and dad, well, she started doing it by herself first, and then it was a lot of work, and so my dad gave up what he was doing and joined her, and they did it for, as I said, for about 4 years. And it was just one of those things, you know. I was on a film set one day where they're expecting, you know, it was 16 kids to turn up for this sequence they were going to film, and not all the kids showed up. And the first assistant director just came over to my mum and said, "Does your kid want to be on the TV show?" And she said, "Probably." And so that's how I got my first job. And later on, when I started like seriously looking for acting jobs, the little bits and pieces that I did as a kid actually meant something. So, and I certainly did, being on film sets as a young age and understanding the thing that somebody who's just watching TV or watching movies doesn't necessarily understand, that not every door went somewhere on a film set, you know? So I really knew the difference between somebody thinking they were entering a world and somebody actually understanding that there's artifice involved in this. So I think that made me, at a younger age, a little wiser than actors of a similar age, because they didn't have that experience. They didn't have that on-set experience. So it ended up, as you say, you know, working very well for me down the track.
And at age six, you got your first guitar, first step into the world of entertainment. And it feels like there was always that duality between music and acting. When you learned the first three guitar chords, did that just open up a whole other world to you?
Yeah, it was interesting to me because I don't necessarily can remember why I was asking for a guitar, but where we were staying at Christmas time at my grandfather's house, and next door was a guy who was an actor. His name was Reg Livermore, and he used to have these great parties, and there was always guitars there being passed around and people singing songs. So it probably, it's witnessing that sort of made me interested in having my own guitar. And when I got the guitar for Christmas, I walked across the garden to Reg's place because there was no fence. And there was a guy there who volunteered to teach me chords, and he taught me some chords. So I went back to my grandfather's place and went upstairs to the bedroom that I was staying in, and I wrote a song, which is very interesting, you know, for a six-year-old kid to understand that as a creative outlet for him. So I didn't get a guitar wanting to learn other people's songs. I got a guitar wanting to try and express what was in my imagination. So, yeah, you know, the funny thing is that first acting job and the getting the guitar is the same year. So it was a simultaneous start, and it remains a simultaneous pursuit to this day.
And you started playing in bands then, I think, around the age of 14. You were touring when you were just 16. Was it always the grand plan, like that parallel tracks of music and acting, even at those earliest age into your teenage years?
Not at all. Not at all. The acting bits I did because of circumstance, you know. Even when I was 12, I got a couple of episodes on a very popular Australian soap called The Young Doctors, right? But I went to the studio on a school trip. I was there with 25, 30 other school kids of my age, people from my, you know, class and what have you. And I just happened to bump into an older Welsh actor called Roy Harris Jones, who I'd worked with on one of those shows I did as a kid. And he goes, you know, typical actor's question, what are you working on? You know, and I'm like, oh, mate, I haven't had a job since that thing we did together, you know? And he goes, no, Russell, you can't, no, come with me. And he took me down the hallway and just burst in on the casting agent and made some big speech about, you've got to meet this kid, you've got to talk to this kid. And she must have had a bit of spare time, so I sat down and talked with her. Now, the rest of the class, they're off on this tour. They don't know where I am. I'm in with the casting agent having a conversation. And basically, she took notes of everything I said. You know, at that point in time, my mum and dad were running pubs. You know, so she said, what do your mum and dad do? I said, they run hotels. And she said, so where do you live? I said, oh, we actually live in the hotel. She said, oh, that must be interesting and everything. I said, well, it can be quite noisy. And whatever I said to her in this normal, natural conversation, she's making notes. A couple of weeks later, you know, because I told her which pub my dad was running, you know, there's a note there from the casting agent saying, hey, please read this script and, you know, see if you'd want to play this role.
Amazing.
So basically she'd taken the notes from my real life, which was really about having lots and lots of time to myself because my mum and dad were always working. And so I got another job, you know. But, you know, from the time I was in high school, music was my only real pursuit. And when I left school, my kind of mindset was, I don't care what the job is as long as it's connected to entertainment in some way, you know. So very quickly, in fact, before I left school, I found myself working in nightclubs as a DJ. And it was in the second club that I worked at, the guy that I was working for, I actually told him that I write songs. And he said, well, play me some of your songs. So I did. And he goes, mate, you should get on stage. So I started doing this thing where I was, you know, DJ, and the last set every night, I would get up and play original songs. Now, the rest of the format of the nightclub was 1950s songs. So for you to stand up there and then play an original song in that kind of environment, you know, people aren't expecting it. They don't necessarily want it. That's not what they're here for. But it was, you know, like a real baptism of fire for me because I had to, you know, convert that audience, bring that audience onto my side.
Let's take your first piece of music when you were back writing your earliest songs that you've talked about there. Was there something that struck you about the stories of Jim Croce?
The reason I chose Jim Croce, my dad thought me and my brother were being kind of, you know, negatively influenced by Sydney, you know, and he was probably right because we did have a lot of time on our hands because mum and dad were always working. So, and the last hotel that he was running was a place called the Occidental, and it was right in the middle of the city. So, you know, we were seeing things that you probably don't want your kids at that age to be seeing necessarily, you know, even given that my dad was a hotel manager, you know, pub manager. So he decided that we were going to move back to New Zealand. And the way I've described that is it was basically like shifting back in time, you know. Now, the Jim Croce of it all is my mum used to do a thing with us as boys where, you know, if you were sick at home and you had to take some time off school, she would always find a way to get off work and drop in. And usually she would have gotten some candy or something or, you know, here's a book or a comic or whatever, you know, sorry, you're feeling sick. This particular day she arrived and I was hoping for something with chocolate in it, but I got an album, and it was kind of slightly insulting because it was a big round sticker on the front that said bargain price $1.99. So I knew she hadn't committed heavily to this purchase. And I said, why did you buy me that? I've never heard of this guy. And she goes, you're going to love his songs.
Well, let's take a listen at that to Jame Croce, Time in a Bottle.
If I could save time in a bottle, the first thing that I'd like to do is to save every day till eternity passes away, just to spend them with you. If I could make days last forever.
And that was Time in a Bottle by Jame Croce, the first musical choice of our guest this morning, Russell Crowe. We're going to stay back in time with your next choice, Russell Crowe. What went off in your head when you heard the Boomtown Rats for the first time?
Well, the first Boomtown Rats song I ever heard was Mary of the Fourth Form. But you see, Bob Geldof became quite a big influence on me from a songwriting perspective. And, you know, people sort of don't necessarily, you know, remember him that way because of the Live Aid thing took over his persona in such a big way. But I was an absolute devotee of the Boomtown Rats and particularly of Bob Geldof as a songwriter, and that includes his solo work as well. You know, obviously, as an actor, you need to have quite a fertile imagination because you're living in a world of pretend a lot of the time. And this song, with its intricate story and its complex run of emotions, but also its changes in groove, I just absolutely love this song. You know, I think I first heard it probably like 78, 79, something like that. And yeah, I bought everything I could of the Boomtown Rats. And they actually came to New Zealand to tour. And it was like, I was so excited about it. I ended up doing something that my mum wasn't happy with me about, and she grounded me and I wasn't allowed to go to the concert. So it's a terrible experience. Well, but I love the band.
Let's take you back in time to the Boomtown Rats and take a listen to Rat Trap.
Billy don't like it living here in this town.
He said,
traps have been sprung long before he was born.
He said,
hold fast the dust behind all the closed doors. And pus and grime ooze from its scab-busted zone. You need a better. You're young and good looking and you're acting kind of dumb anyway.
Boomtown Rats there with Rat Trap, the second musical choice of my guest, Russell Crowe. Russell, you're coming to us in Ireland next month with the Indoor Garden Party and the Gentleman Barbers. And you've had many albums over your careers, a lot of songwriting. And I imagine albums always feel cyclical. You know, it's about the highs and lows of life, the peaks and valleys. Where do you think you're at the moment in terms of your musical writing? Is it a time of positivity for you?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. You know, I think you go through phases, you know, as a songwriter. I thought for a long period there when I was a young man that I could only ever write unrequited love songs, but I have definitely moved on and taking on other subjects, you know. I find a great deal of joy in it now. It does come in fits and starts, but what tends to happen with me is the more busy I am, the more songs come. You'd wish it was the other way around, right? When you've got plenty of time and you're nice and relaxed and there's nothing, you know, burning your time up, but that's just not a reality for me. It'll be, you know, a day where I've worked 15 hours or whatever, and then I'm suddenly waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning taking notes about something that is on my mind.
You're bringing those songs all over the world, including here to Dublin in July. But one of your stop-offs is going to be Rome, of course. You're going to play the Colosseum, which will not be lost on anyone. And you're Rome's ambassador in the world as well, which I hadn't realised. How surreal is that going to be for you to go back to what is kind of like the old office for you?
Yeah, well, it's going to be very interesting. I mean, it's the, you know, the city of Rome gave me the opportunity to do it, and I couldn't say no. I mean, we're playing on the Venus platform, which is, you know, directly in front of the Colosseum. You know, it's been like 25 years of a beautiful relationship I've had with the people of Italy, and it, you know, part of that is to do with the fact that I simply love the country, but obviously a heavy, large part of that is to do with the fact that I played Maximus in Gladiator. But just recently, I found out that I actually have Italian relatives, so I'm part Italian, and we actually know where they come from and everything. So that's, it's so weird to have had such a like a kindred spirit. This is very similar to the way I feel about Ireland. And recently I found out I have all of these Irish relatives as well, which we didn't know about before. But to have that instinctive sense that there's some kind of belonging aspect to the relationship, and then to find out two and a half decades later, that's reality. This is very cool.
You mentioned, of course, Gladiator, and you were a hugely accomplished actor before Gladiator. And I know you're being plagued with questions about the sequel, but we're interested here in Ireland because, of course, our own Paul Mescal, who we're very proud of, is going to be in it. And I wonder, did you have any opportunity to give him advice going into this sequel? Do you think it could be life-changing for him in the way that it was for you?
I don't know, and I would never presume to give an actor of the experience of Paul advice. I think no doubt he's had a very similar situation to what I experienced in that, you know, he stepped into something that is just larger than life, a Ridley Scott set where he's creating an entire world is an incredible thing to be on. And hopefully he had fun doing it, you know, and it gave him some satisfaction. I mean, you know, it's a long, long time ago for me, but, you know, I absolutely have no problem saying that, you know, I'm a little melancholy about it because it's sort of like, you know, it definitely means I'm getting old if they're remaking something that I've done. And it's not the only one. I've been told they're remaking a couple of other things I've done as well. So I was like, oh, bloody hell. I'm really at that point, you know? But I'm sort of quite proud of the fact that it took them 25 years to get around to doing it. And they obviously think that now they can do it and not sort of negatively affect the reputation of the first one or whatever. But, you know, from the things that I've heard, there are ideas that we had back in the day that we simply couldn't pull off because the technology wasn't there. And I've heard that they've, explored a couple of those ideas, which is going to be fantastic. Some of those ideas are very exciting. But look, I'm just really happy for him as long as, you know, he's enjoyed himself and he's had fun. And Ireland is, you know, is right to be proud of the young fella. He's doing well. So just all power to him.
Very good. Let's take another piece of music, Russell Crowe. Will you introduce for us the next song from Elvis Costello?
Elvis is definitively a mentor in my musical journey. I actually met him. He didn't remember this when we met as, you know, much later in life, but he came into that club I was talking to you about before. And I was DJing and he was the only person in the room at 8 o'clock. He had a concert on that night at Auckland Town Hall. He didn't know the town, had nowhere to go. He saw the sign, you know, recognized the name of the club was an Elvis Presley movie title. So he came in. So basically I spent about, you know, an hour, 15 hour, 20 minutes DJing for him. Sort of just playing songs that I thought he might be interested in. And he stayed in his seat. So many, many years later, we actually get to meet and we're talking. And I said to him, you know, man, we have actually met before. And he goes, oh, no, I'd remember. And I go, no, look, man, I was this DJ in this nightclub in Auckland. And he goes, was that you? He goes, for years, I was going around telling people, if they're in Auckland, they got to check out the music that guy plays at the club because it was just so authentic. You were digging into like 1950s tracks and everything that I was like, whoa, you know. And anyway, so that set our conversation off in a really good way. And the thing is Elvis has gotten up as a guest for us when we've been playing. And I got up with him as a guest when he played Royal Albert Hall 10 or 12 years ago. And you can probably still hear the influence of Elvis Costello in the songs that I write today.
Okay, well, let's take a listen to Elvis Costello, Please Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood.
Sure.
And that was Elvis Costello, Please Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood. Another musical choice from Russell Crowe this morning. When you're on stage performing, Russell, are you taking on a different role? What's that feeling like? You step on stage and you go to the mic.
Well, it's a very different thing because I'm not taking on a role. You know, for certain, I know I'm walking on stage and I'm going to be doing a live performance. But the difference is that's me, you know, and the stories that I tell and the way that I communicate with an audience, that's me. It's not prescribed by a script or by, you know, a time period or, you know, the research that I've done for a character. It's a very, very different thing in that respect, you know. So you're walking into a performance area unburdened by the things that you would be carrying if you were doing a film.
And hopefully some of the unburdening you get from a musician like Etta James. We're going to come to that song. Just introduce for us Done in the Dark.
Etta James, I discovered while I was shooting the movie The Insider, and we played her every day when I was sitting in the makeup chair. And through that period of time, we actually got to go and see her live at the House of Blues in Los Angeles. She has the most incredible voice and such a long, long history. So it is a joy to go on a journey looking for Etta James songs. And this is a great track from an album called Love's Been Rough on Me. And this is a song called Done in the Dark.
I'm sick and tired of you sneaking around in the mood to go across town, drinking in the closet and lying all the time, sending the money, don't care about the bills.
And that was Done in the Dark from Etta James, the fourth musical choice of our guest this morning, Russell Crowe. Russell, as we said, you're coming back to Ireland. This is a return to Ireland. You've been here many times. Will you have your sons with you? Are they following you into the life of being a singer, a songwriter?
Both my boys are actually going to be with me in Dublin. One of them's travelling with me at the beginning of the tour, but the other one joins us in Dublin and will be around on the road with us for a couple of weeks because it's school holidays. My eldest son, Charlie, is a very good songwriter, and he will probably get up on stage in Dublin and do one of his songs. We have other guests in Dublin as well. Janet Devlin's going to be opening up for us. Lorraine O'Reilly is going to do a little set before, as well as being in the main set. But there's also a special guest that only people who are really indoor garden party fans will know. But when he walks on that stage, he's going to blow the roof off the joint. So I'm really looking forward to people seeing that. But yeah, Charlie writes great songs. I'm not sure if he wants to pursue music as an actual career. He's at university at the moment. He's studying Latin and ancient Greek. He's got a great brain and he's a very good writer. So there are many, many options for him in terms of what he'd do as a career. In fact, both of my sons, I think it's to do with the fact that I read to them so much when they were little. They're very good at expressing their thoughts in words and coming up with narratives and stories and stuff, both of them.
Well, I hope they enjoy their time in Ireland. What's the one thing you're looking forward to on your return to Ireland, Russell Crowe?
It's going to be that moment where I walk out on stage to that Irish audience. You know, we played there last time in 2017. We played at the Olympia, and that was such a great response. And I was really under the weather for that gig. So I'm just hoping that when I walk out on the stage this time, I've got some nice ping in the top notes of my voice and we can have a really fun concert.
Very good. We'll introduce your last musical choice for us this morning, Johnny Cash with I Hung My Head.
Back to that nightclub that I was telling you about that I used to work at. And I used to sort of play his songs there. And, you know, it was a very strange age, you know, and time really, because it's the mid-70s. So it's the time of punk and new wave and, early 80s by the time I'm working at that, you know, so punk and new wave and you've got all these sort of, you know, hard edge bands, rock and roll bands, but then you've got the sort of Human League and bands like that taking us into a more sort of synthy pop thing. And for a living, what I did was play 12-bar blues songs. So to find amongst all that, Johnny Cash was kind of like a, a real benefit and a bonus for me, a guy that was singing story songs. I do definitely take a lot of influence, but I chose this particular song because, you know, sometimes you can write a song that you think is about something that you've experienced, and then you realize later that you've actually predicted a certain level of future for yourself. And one of the people that I like to talk to about writing songs is Sting. And Sting said to me a sort of similar thing, you know, one night over a few drinks. He said, listen, man, I don't actually know where they come from, but I just know that if I sit to write a song, songs will come. So this song, I Hung My Head, is a song written by Sting. In the middle of doing, you know, an album about lutes or whatever, he ends up writing a country and western song. And I liked his version, but the core of the song, the soul of the song, didn't really become apparent to me until it was sung in Johnny Cash's voice.
Russell Crowe, thank you so much for sharing your time with us and stories today on The Brendan O'Connor Show.
Cheers. Thank you very, very much.
The Indoor Garden Party takes place in the Gaiety Theatre, Dublin, on July 1. And this is Russell Crowe's last musical choice for today, Johnny Cash with I Hung My Head.
Here in the courthouse, the whole town was there. I see the judge high up in his chair. Explain to the courtroom what went through your mind. And we'll ask the jury what verdict they find. I felt the power of death over life. I orphaned his children